You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 412 of the Fabulous Podcast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Episode 412, and this one is not for the 12s. Very little Seahawks talk.
If you're excited about Lincoln Tomlinson, yes. If you're excited about the draft, still no. Maybe I'll think about that next week.
Maybe we'll get to it. I don't know. Isn't next week the week of the draft or is the week before the draft?
I believe next week is, in fact, the week of the draft.
The draft is 9 days from now? A week from Thursday?
I'm not sure about that, but...
Like, this is how checked out of the... It's every mock draft that I see, it's this, like, Troy Fautanu that I feel like the mock draft experts are just like, that is who the Seahawks are taking. And every second, John Schneider is like, I want to go out of my way to tell you, we are not drafting Troy Fautanu.
Yes, Thursday, April 25th. Seahawks will be trading down, possibly out of the first round entirely.
I love how confident we are about this. Like, if they make a big splash in the draft, there's going to be egg on our face. But I went through and did the... This is almost too much mock draft. This is for the 12s for episode 412.
Okay.
But I went through and did the ESPN mock draft simulator thing, which it's just like, can you just have the top picks be what we all know are going to be the top three picks? That's my thing that I always hate about mock draft simulators, which is just like, we know quarterbacks are going 1, 2, 3. Or, like, they have such wild variation in it. And I'm like, this is too much variation. You've gone too far here. But I don't know if there is really an outcome in this draft for the Seahawks that I would be that excited about. Whereas last year, it was like, Jaxon Smith-Njigba was there at pick, pick 18?
Something like that.
Like, there were so many... I didn't even know how much I loved Devin Witherspoon at the time. There were so many different ways for that draft to be a fun draft for the Seahawks. And this one, based upon the positional need that the Seahawks have, unless for some reason they draft Michael Penix in the second round or the late first round, I cannot imagine a way that I would be that excited about this draft for the Seahawks.
Yeah, maybe that's it. The fact that it's not skill positions that they're likely to draft at all.
I'm not saying that they're going to have a good draft or a bad draft or whatever. It's just like... This is just going to be a bunch of players who are going to be on the team. And for this moment, the draft part of the excitement, not the playing part of the excitement of football, I'm just like, it'll be fine. Whoever they draft, it'll be good. It's like when they drafted Jordan Brooks. It's just like, all right, well, they drafted Jordan Brooks. Probably reached.
Actually, I believe if you check on Reddit, our analysis of that year's draft was a bit more pessimistic than, all right, they drafted Jordan Brooks.
We were right, though, right?
I mean, Jordan Brooks turned out to be fine.
I feel like his performance on the field, as Seahawks tenure, which is now over for the time being, matched our enthusiasm.
Guaranteed a second go.
I'm just saying, I don't want to rule it out. It's the Seahawks.
But it's not relevant to the draft pick, even if he comes back.
Yes. But so the value that they got from Jordan Brooks as a draft pick, maybe it was average. Maybe it honestly might have even been above average value that they got for that particular draft pick. But it was still kind of like, all right, right?
I think that is accurate. I would compare
it more... I think Zach Whitman was way more negative about it than we were, by the way.
I don't dispute
that. We were all locked in our fucking houses. We were like, next week when we're out of this lockdown. That was us.
I don't think in April 2024, we thought we were just a week away.
We probably didn't even really know if the season was going to happen.
That is a more plausible depiction of where we were in April 2020. What was the last time they drafted like an offensive lineman in the first? Well, obviously, like, a couple of years ago they drafted Charles Cross.
Yes,
but like an interior offensive.
We were so excited about Charles Cross, though.
We also had like mapped out all the different scenarios, which is what you can do when you have a top 10 pick.
Yes.
Whereas when you have the 16th pick, it's like, Troy Fautanu is going to be there. Maybe one of the defensive tackles.
And there are people who are paying more attention to the draft that are like, that's who we'd really love to see.
Latu.
But I feel like he's probably going to be there, and I don't think the Seahawks will take him.
Fautanu or Latu?
Latu. I definitely don't think... They have gone out of their way to tell us that they are not drafting Fautanu.
Signed a starting guard this week.
Exactly. We'll talk about later, and you know what? Podcast. People have not changed anything in their mock drafts. It is just like, he went to UW, the Seahawks need a guard, we're good, check, done. He will be there at this pick.
It's like the last year, the mock draft where they had players being chosen by near where they were.
Oh, yeah. But what was the mistake? Peter Skoronski from Northwestern. No. But
I don't know what kind of rookie season Peter Skoronski
had. I think he had a very good rookie season, okay, actually.
Good.
But
Jackson Smith and Jigba was the 20th pick. The 20th. By the way, you didn't note, though, in terms of players who could potentially be there and the Seahawks wouldn't trade down. I think this was Danny Kelly that flagged this. Somebody said that Brock Bowers, it might have been Schefter, said that Brock Bowers' range was 10 to 16.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I will say if Brock Bowers is there, I think that would be exciting. And do you know who would really be excited about that? Baby Fantasy Genius with his multiple uggas.
Oh, I hadn't thought of Babyest Fantasy Genius. Babyest, yes.
Fantasy Genius. He
that might make him a Seahawks fan.
He would maybe would be a Seahawks fan if they take Ladd McConkey or Brock Bowers. Amarius Mims, I don't know. I don't know if Amarius Mims does it, but one of those.
Is the kicker with the glasses in this draft?
Blankenship?
Yeah.
Isn't he been in the NFL for years?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Are you asking if he's going back? This is when I correct you in the podcast. This is a weekly correction.
Oh, no.
You're like, is Jake Locker coming out in this one?
He was drafted in 2020. I don't know where then.
We were in lockdown. Oh, you don't even remember it.
Kicked for multiple teams. Oh, dear.
Wow.
Way off on that one.
Your descent into madness is happening live on the Pelotoncast.
Well, look, if it's Rodrigo Blankenship, I can take it.
Anyway,
that's not that big of a deal.
I feel like there's been enough Seahawks draft talk.
All right.
We have to have somebody on next week.
Box.
Yeah, we have to have somebody on next week to talk about the draft because we don't know anything.
It's true.
You're not willing to commit to that. You were like, I'll stand by our not knowing anything.
No, I was planning to do some research next week.
But okay, Brock Bowers I would be excited about. But beyond that, I'm just like, I just don't know. Because there's certain...
But the other aspect of it is not just, I don't know. It's also, this is all probably fine. Just like,
oh,
they're
no,
probably
not
going to take
not consternated
a running
about it.
Back. I suppose they could take an off-ball linebacker, but everyone thinks the crop of those players in this year's draft is very poor, right? Probably not taking a safety.
It's a really weird draft.
I agree. Apparently, they're going to set a record for offensive players getting drafted.
That's what I was going to say.
And possibly offensive linemen.
It's a lot of offensive players getting drafted, but the Seahawks are kind of set at most offense, especially skill positions outside of tight end.
Let's hope so.
I mean, if they took a wide receiver, like, you know, if they took Jalen McMillan, Jalen Polk in the second round, all of a sudden we're talking. But I don't know if I really see it.
This is the other weird thing is I haven't been able to get that excited about this draft. And like, it's going to be the most Huskies drafted.
Well, there's a little bit of a cloud hanging over it with regards to the Huskies.
Fair.
That it still feels a little strange.
With Kaywin DeBoer's departure?
Yeah. Just the way that the season ended and everything that happened after. It's not like, it feels like the program just completely changed.
It's not the like coronation of the program that it would be if Kaywin DeBoer was there at the table with Roma Dunze.
Yes.
As he went in the top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's fair. Which I guess he might
also,
be.
Also, let me just say, people are underrating Roma Dunze right now.
I feel like people are reading Roma Dunze quite hot.
He went from being in conversation of one of the first wide receivers taken to clearly the third wide receiver taken. And I don't.
So it's Marvin Harrison Jr. and then who?
I feel like Malik Nabers. There's like a debate between those two. All of a sudden, Roma Dunze does not seem to be part of that debate. And to me, Roma Dunze is just as good as either of those receivers.
Marvin Harrison Jr. is pretty good. All right. He's pretty good.
He was not put in as difficult positions as Roma Dunze was put into.
Probably not. All right, let's get to this week's toast, starting with some sad news, is we learned that longtime Sonics assistant coach Bob Kloppenberg, affectionately known as Kloppy, died at age 96 on Tuesday morning. After coaching at the amateur level, Kloppenberg got his first NBA job under Lenny Wilkins in 1980-81. I actually didn't realize that until I was doing the research. Then returned to the Sonics in 1985 with Bernie Bickerstaff and spent 10 years working under Bickerstaff, Casey Jones, and then George Karl as the architect of the SOS pressure defense that was sort of the base for the Sonics during their great success in the 1990s. His son, Gary Kloppenberg, also used that with the Storm, including acting head coach during the 2020 season in the bubble when the Storm won the championship and other WNBA teams. And a third generation of Kloppenberg coaches already is his granddaughter, Carlota Kloppenberg Pruitt, has also followed Bob into coaching. Currently, the
is she
head
Italian?
Coach, Carlota?
Yeah.
I don't know if her mom is, possibly. Currently is the head coach at NAIA Southern Oregon, where she has won Cascade Conference Coach of the Year twice in her 3 years at the helm.
Okay.
And an ongoing tie to this, the Tennessee Volunteers under Rick Barnes have been using SOS defense and giving it and Kloppy a lot of credit as one of the best defenses in the country in the NCAA in recent years. Like, that will certainly be a legacy that that lasts, beyond Bob Kloppenberg passing away.
All right.
But I think also just a beloved figure with the 90s Sonics. I don't know if this is as salient a memory for you as it was for me when Robert Horry, kicked Kloppy on the bench when fell into the Sonics bench. This was, I assume, was early in the 93-94 season, because it was, I think, when both teams were undefeated and they had just played in the playoffs last year, and Robert Horry became, villain number one in Seattle for a few weeks there.
Absolutely.
And then I was fortunate enough to, I certainly know Gary Kloppenberg quite well from his time with the Storm, but interviewed Bob for a story on the 86-87 Sonics I did while I was working for the team website, and that was a great thrill, a great treat, and he had a lot of terrific memories of that season. So, a wonderful life, a wonderful legacy for Bob Kloppenberg, who passed away at age 96. All right, and happier news, congrats to Mariners outfielder Jonathan Clase, who had his first career hit in his Major League debut on Monday.
All right.
You have nothing to add on this?
We'll get there in the Mariners section. Right. I will say I pulled up Peter Schrager's mock draft number one. Guess who he has the Seahawks taking?
Troy Fiatone?
Of course!
I thought you were saying that because it was going to be like a surprise.
No, he also has Roma Dunze ahead of Malik Nabers, for what it's worth. He has Roma Dunze at pick six.
Okay. All right, congrats to Storm center Ezzie Megbegor, who was named to the All-EuroLeague first team ahead of last weekend's Final Four. Megbegor averaged 13.2 points, 8.2 rebounds, and 2.4 blocks for USK Praha, leading all EuroLeague players in blocks this season. Staying on the WNBA theme, congrats to Gig Harbor's Brennan Maxwell, drafted number 13 overall by the Chicago Sky out of Gonzaga.
Wow. You know I love GH.
You do?
Absolutely, I love Gig Harbor. Always.
I didn't even know you had Gig Harbor takes.
Oh, yeah. Gig Harbor's amazing.
It's one of your favorite harbors?
Oh, top 10. I don't know. The little main drag in Gig Harbor, Seven Seas Brewing. Gig Harbor's where it's at.
I haven't spent that much time in Gig Harbor, but do love Seven Seas Brewing, that's for sure.
We stayed at a houseboat in Gig Harbor. It was awesome, right next to the new Seven Seas location.
That, yeah.
They've got a really fun little park there. I went to a baseball field 3 weeks ago in Gig Harbor. It was awesome.
Okay.
The baseball field. And they had a great park right next door. Basketball court wide open because it was Gig Harbor. It was great. The entire experience. A lot of people walking their dogs. Nobody on the basketball court.
Well, what was the weather like?
It was really nice.
Oh, okay.
It was beautiful. There were tons of people there at the park.
All right.
Yeah, no, I'm a big GH guy. That's what we call it around here. Lots of people.
I thought
it was so funny that people were shocked that I love Snohomish.
I was kind of shocked that you love Snohomish.
That was a little left field because, again, at the same time, I call it Queen Anne, North Seattle. But
yeah.
But there was an insinuation that I'd never been to the Tulip Festival. And I was like, born and raised in Seattle. You think I haven't been to the Tulip Festival?
Is the Tulip Festival, it's in Skagit County.
Yeah.
Not Snohomish County. So is that,
but
does that count?
I'm just saying there was insinuation that I
that you have never been north of the city of Seattle?
Some of my favorite places, you're talking GH, the Skagit Valley Co-op, that is number one. Any chance I have to go. See, you're the one who doesn't know about this shit right here. The Skagit Valley Co-op is if I could travel to almost anywhere in the state, that's top five in the state. That's ahead of Gig Harbor.
I mean, you're not as familiar with downtown Everett as I got when the Storm were playing two seasons there.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with downtown Everett.
If you don't have your pizza spot in downtown Everett, I can't talk to you.
But no, I fuck hard with the Skagit Valley Co-op.
Okay, shout out Skagit Valley. Toast to the Skagit Valley Co-op.
You have never been there?
No.
It's amazing. It is like a destination.
I haven't been to the Tulip Festival since I was a kid.
Wow. You should maybe take a trip. I think it's happening right now.
I don't know if you're aware of this. Weekends aren't great for me right now.
Anyway, stop off in Skagit Valley. You go to the co-op, get some food. They've got great refrigerated food. It's excellent. The whole experience is amazing.
Okay. Well, good to know. Anyway, the Brennan Maxwell, congrats on being drafted by the Sky. The Gonzaga-Chicago Sky connection brought us Courtney Vandersloot. We'll see if Bruno Maxwell
didn't bring us Courtney Vandersloot. Brought the world Courtney Vandersloot. There was that one moment.
That one set of tweets.
The very end of the podcast. I'm pro.
Gonzaga women's basketball?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, wow.
How dare you insinuate that?
Wow.
By the way, are we aware that Drake dissed Oregon? Is this true?
I have not followed this story enough to know that whether it was actually an AI-generated track or a real Drake track.
I haven't seen it being a thing. I think it's a fake thing. But I will just say straight up, honestly, I'm pro-AI music, if that's where AI music is going.
Going to tell that to your artists.
I mean, I keep trying to convince them in the indie rock songs to include Oregon not having any national championships. Nobody's bit yet, but we'll see. There's always time. I'm pro Gig Harbor. I can't get behind the rest of it, though.
All right. Congrats to Pelton Cast Fantasy NBA champion Nathan Holmes.
There we go.
Both Nathan and Aaron Robertson should let us know about sending cookies. Aaron, we didn't mention that last week for your NCAA tournament pool win. I've already connected with Nate Taggart, who was the other winner.
What did he choose? What kind of cookies?
We've not decided that because he's currently out of traveling, so we decided to put it off until he's back in the country.
All right.
Farewell to John Ryan, who signed a contract with the Seahawks Tuesday in order to officially retire as a member of the team. Ryan waived by the Seahawks in 2018 training camp. Do you go to Dino's Pub afterwards? Was that where he was eating lunch and people just were buying him drinks?
It kind of makes sense.
I think that's right. And spent one more
offensive coordinators are announced.
Exactly. It spent one more season with the Bills before playing in the CFL in 2019 and 2021. He announced his retirement in July 2022, I think, from the CFL. But maybe I'm misremembering that now. Ryan spent 10 seasons in total.
You think he's in the draft this year?
Yeah. And, of course, as we all know, currently a co-owner of the Portland Pickles of the West Coast League. Saw some merch for that while I was in Portland last weekend.
For the Pickles? They're a real team. I don't really understand what the Portland Pickles are.
It's a wood bat amateur baseball league. I think it might be the league that Golden Tate played in.
Golden Tate played in? I kind of remember that, actually. Yeah.
The commissioner
He played in Tacoma, right?
No, it was on the peninsula. There's not any in the greater, I don't know. I'm in danger of... I've looked at the map, but I'm in danger of, if I say in the greater Puget Sound area.
Say it.
But I think it was on the peninsula.
People are wanting you to say
it. Say the line.
Incorrect geography.
You know who the commissioner of this league is?
Who's that?
Rob Dyer, my one-time ESPN colleague.
Really? That's a strange job to have.
Yeah. Yes, it is. I agree.
I feel like all of the minor league baseball teams should just be playing banana ball, right? If you're going to be playing semi-pro baseball, why wouldn't you at least play fun semi-pro baseball?
That's a fair question. I think it appears I'm safe on this one. There's definitely a team in Port Angeles and one in Victoria, British Columbia. But no, not what you would consider inner Puget Sound.
Okay.
So, and then the Bellingham Bells, of course.
That's where Jake Locker played. Right? He did play for the Bellingham Bells.
Did he? Was it this incarnation? Or was it back when they were an actual minor league team?
That might have been when they were a minor league team.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have time to look through the... they were in the Pacific International League.
That is kind of right up our alley.
What?
Is fringe sports teams around random Northwest cities or regionally into Canada?
Oh, yes, I guess that is true. I don't know why.
We don't have time for this. The Peltoncast would never spend time talking about sports franchises.
No, it's more it's not fun. If we're naming the Kelowna Rockets off the top of our head, that's fun. The Kamloops Blazers.
The WHL
so
is like,
so
that's our number one league that we'd never pay attention to.
But yet somehow, no, just instinctively know the
As long as you don't bring
teams.
Up the Turhawks.
Like those are just, you know, snug in my brain. I may not remember that Rodrigo Blankenship has been in the NFL for multiple seasons, but
Kelowna's right in there. The Tri-Cities Americans.
Yeah, that's never going anywhere.
They were interviewing on Root Sports is just on in my house now, but like, it's because I gotta earn that. They have to earn that $18 a month, so I just have to be playing it constantly. But they were interviewing one of the Kraken like call ups who was playing for the Coachella Valley.
Oh, we've got some Coachella Valley talk later in this very podcast.
There we go. It is Coachella week, and we're not even talking about that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is not about Grimes DJ set. This is about minor league hockey.
Do you want to get sent down to Coachella Valley during Coachella? Or do
no,
you
absolutely
not.
I think you definitely do not want to be there.
Probably not. I forgot to put this in the notes. So this I am going to do live. The Alki Beach Invitational hosted by UW Women's Beach Volleyball last weekend, which sadly I missed out on.
You didn't get to walk down there? You couldn't walk to Alki.
I'd be a very healthy
It'd have
walk.
To be at the other beach.
I've biked most of the way to Alki, but okay. A walk is a long ways. They lost to number 15 Georgia State on Saturday, apparently. Overall, a 4-1 weekend, this record this weekend at home. Okay. We also apparently have
pretty
learned...
Nice weekend for beach volleyball
in Seattle.
Perfect
weekend for it.
That's a risky play, I'm not going to lie.
I agree, yeah. You got to do it, rain or shine. I am learning also from the UW Beach Volleyball's page that they are set to join the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation in 2024-25.
The what? Say that again?
The Mountain Pacific Sports Federation.
The UW Volleyball is?
The beach volleyball.
Is that
indoor volleyball will play in the Big Ten, which has many volleyball teams. But they don't,
beach volleyball doesn't
weirdly,
have
they don't do beach volleyball in Nebraska. I mean, I don't know.
Are
maybe they
in
do.
The Pac-12 right now?
They are currently in the Pac-12.
So they're having to join. This is kind of the crazy thing. It's just like
they will.
Fox wants to show football, and all of a sudden they're playing.
Again, the dominoes. Yeah,
the dominoes going from Fox wanting to show college football games to all of a sudden they have to play in what is the conference?
Mountain Pacific Sports Federation, which
not even a conference.
They will be in along with Cal, Oregon, Stanford, UCLA, and USC. Wow, I wonder what those teams have in common, schools have in common, along with Grand Canyon.
Wow.
So, there you go.
They might even set off the Clone Wars.
That immediately makes the MPSF the premier beach conference in the country. Neither the Big Ten nor the
ACC.
It's
not a conference. Stop. It's a federation.
You could be both, I suppose.
No.
Neither the Big Ten nor the ACC sponsor beach volleyball, giving the teams exiting the Pac-12 conference the opportunity to remain united.
Great.
Well, we're going to have to learn more about the MPSF, but apparently UW was in there in indoor track and field from 1993 through 2020. So
no, fair enough.
Today I learned. We're just finding out all sorts of things today. All right, well, I think that wraps up our toast. I don't know if there's any other sports leagues or Peltoncast geography we want to get
to. Fringe Northwest or Canadian cities that we want to mention.
I guess, well, we should say while we're on this note before we get to our...
Is there a team at Bouchard Gardens?
Fully to our search for Seattle. I mean, the Victoria team is the one that's close to it. Yeah, you could knock those both out in one day if you go to the Woodbat Baseball League. And then Bouchard Gardens. Before we get into our search for Seattle's best cookie, wanted to note we're wishing the best to Snoqualmie Pie Company and the other companies displaced by a fire to a historic building in downtown Snoqualmie that many people on the Discord, including you, first thought was Snohomish Pie Company, which we talked about last week on this podcast.
Oh, so this is it's the same pie company?
No.
Oh, this is a totally different pie company.
Unrelated pie company.
Okay. Because there are two locations of...
Snohomish
Pie Company. Aren't there?
It's Mount Lake Terrace is the other
one.
Location.
Is it Mount Lake Terrace? Mount Lake Terrace?
I don't know. That's
okay. We need to stop right now.
We'll sort that out on the Discord.
Yeah. I've already praised Gig Harbor. Look, I've talked about the co-op. I don't want to go any further.
Just tread carefully. But...
this is a totally different location.
Yes, an unrelated company.
How many pie companies are there in this general region? I guess it is the pie region of Washington.
I mean, it's,
or would you say is Central Washington more of the pie region of Washington?
I mean, that's where they grow a lot of the fruits that are going in pies.
This is like the pie region of Western Washington.
I guess so. It's interesting. I searched for Snoqualmie Pie Company, and you know what came up is Snohomish Pie Company. So Snoqualmie Pie Company apparently opened relatively recently, according to the Snoqualmie Valley Record.
Okay.
Which is the first time we've ever cited that publication.
That's where Jan thinks you're going to work.
They opened in September 2023. So, you know, again, hope for the best for them to be able to relocate. We'll have to link the GoFundMe for the relocation for some of these.
I went and got
businesses.
They have Snoqualmie ice cream. I was at Safeway and I was looking for ice cream. Lots of options. I will say shouts to the ice cream buyer at Safeway.
Nice.
They've got my girl Jenny there now. You know what I mean? They've got Jenny's ice cream, Marco ice cream, and they had Snoqualmie ice cream. And I was like, I have to do this, you know, for the cause.
Chickadee Bake Shop, the other food related location that will be displaced. All right, so our search for Seattle's best cookie. Today I was fully intending to go to Cafe Hitchcock and get their cookies, which we've not had since Hitchcock Deli in Georgetown closed, which inspired our original search for Seattle's best cookie, lo, these many years ago. Alas, I got there. They were sold out of cookies.
Oh, that's how you know it's a competitor, though. I'm not going to lie.
They close at 3, so I guess they're at like 2:50, so it wasn't like shocking, but the person did note that it had been a heavy day for cookies, so we'll say.
Cookie day out there.
I mean, again, the original Hitchcock Deli cookie, if it's the same as that was, then it is legitimately a contender. But I think I may have found another one that was not on my list previously, but I was just searching for cookies.
Is there a dog
in the area? So Batch Baking Company in Capitol Hill came up. Again, I was not familiar with them. They opened across from the Seattle U campus on 12th Avenue in 2019. And their cookie options include chocolate chunk, caramel chocolate chunk. Got both of those, of course. M&M's, had a couple bites of the Snickerdoodle, ginger snap, vegan chocolate chunk, and flourless chocolate chip. So a variety of options here. I brought you half of the chocolate chunk and the caramel chocolate chunk. Curious your thoughts.
I honestly thought it was great.
Yeah.
I didn't even kind of no notes. It's one of those things where, you know, I had it way later in the day from you. They're kind of broken in half. I don't know if it struck me as, because again, we're talking about Seattle's best cookie here, right? I think at the very least, this was, I would like to return there again. And
agreed.
If that means that they end up as part of the bracket, I think that makes a lot of sense. This was kind of, I mean, I'd never even heard of it. This is kind of a revelation, to be honest.
So these are pretty flat cookies, since now we've become connoisseurs of the thickness of our cookies, but still quite moist.
Absolutely.
There were large chunks of chocolate in the chocolate chunk. Did you have an issue with that? I remember that was
no,
a bit of a note.
Well, I heated it up too. I'm not going to lie. I kind of like, I gave it like the answers to the test or whatever.
I did not heat it up for the record. No, obviously I was eating it much fresher, but.
Because I was getting it so much later, I put it in the microwave for a few seconds, and that both helps the cookies and it hurts the cookies in some way, because sometimes it makes the like actual cookie part a little bit chewier, but it makes the chocolate chips gooier.
Right.
And so I'm willing to make that trade, the chewy versus gooey trade, of course. And
oh, that's another nexus for us to be considering, the chewy gooey nexus.
I think that's only if you're microwaving cookies. But it was perfect because it was warm and gooey melted chocolate. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to go wrong with that, but I thought having it fresh was also like notably crunchy, which isn't necessarily what I want in my cookies, but it was a pleasant amount of crunch here. So I agree. More research needed on this one, but
I think it's definitely in a good way. Worth it. What are we awarding things? It's funny because I feel like the cookies on the internet don't look as good as the cookies. Oh, that one looks pretty fucking good. But maybe the flourless just like visually are not that great looking. I'm sure that they taste fine, but the types of cookies that they have that people are showing might not be the ones that I would pick if I was there. Like I would probably never get a ginger snap.
Right.
You know, but to me, this was definitely up there with almost anything. I feel like in my head, Hello Robin is the
belt holder.
Yeah. But it for me, and I don't know if it was quite there as far as the consistency getting it this much later, but I definitely want to go back. I think we can slot it into the bracket for now.
Yeah, I mean, especially with the knowledge that, I don't know, I anticipate us concluding this search, you know, in the late summer at this point. So
that's a lot of cookies.
Yes. But so far we have slotted in the bracket. We have Hello Robin, Treat, Chicorina, Bells, Met Market, depending on what we decide to do with that. And yeah, I would agree that Batch goes in there. These are probably a minimum of two Pelton cast peas in terms of notability.
I totally agree.
Yeah. So, you were mentioning a location that you wanted to try to hit up soon.
Snapdragon?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
So it's on Vashon Island. But they're doing a pop-up in West Seattle.
Yeah, and have cookies that are supposed to be amazing.
It's part of the Sunday market? Is that the idea?
I think there's a proper pop-up right now.
Oh, okay. So, if the listener wants to eat along, that's
are we doing that next week?
I mean,
I want to do the Hitchcock ones pretty badly.
I do too.
Yeah, it's just Snapdragon Bakery, open in the Junction.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
On weekends, but not part of the farmer's market.
Okay. Nice. I'm looking forward to checking that out. Did you want to say go with Hitchcock for next week?
I want Hitchcock pretty bad, I'm not going to lie.
Okay.
I'm driving. Are there any Southern cookies?
Are there any Southern cookies? Not that I have on my list.
Okay, because I'm driving to Shelton over the weekend. So if there were any Southern cookies, I can knock those off.
That's next weekend's baseball tournament?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's your schedule. All right, with that, is it time for your favorite segment?
It's the first time we've done this in person in a while. I feel like it's so different doing it in person because when we're on Zoom, you can delete all this. When we're on Zoom, I'm like reading and then I can't look at you.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
I hate to admit it, but I was wrong. I thought what this team needed was a John Marzano, may he rest in peace, on Paul O'Neill style brawl, Jesse Winker, double birds. But in actuality, that wasn't it. But they were missing something. I went to the game on Saturday, as you might have seen on Instagram, and I told the boys when the Mariners scored their first run, you better appreciate it, because that might be the last of the day. And to quote my favorite Hive song, hate to say I told you so, but you could feel it. Cars were setting themselves on fire on the freeway just to feel something. Smoke fueled into the stadium. And for the rest of the game,
I forget you were there for that one.
It resembled the Mariners' offense from Justin's tenure. Another day passed. Castillo pitched a gem, but it wasn't enough. The season felt over on Sunday. And good Lord, does he work in mysterious ways that our Roman brother had to go down for this to happen. But it wasn't a Marzano the Mariners needed. It was an Alex Diaz. They've been saved two consecutive seasons by a spark plug type speedy utility player who seemingly came out of nowhere and turned things around. The front office didn't get it and unceremoniously traded away Cobby for reasons. His WAR would lead the team this year, of course. But enter Jonathan Sparkplug Clase, the speedy utility player the Mariners desperately needed, and the season has been saved. You could feel it instantly, the difference he made in the lineup and in the outfield with excellent defense, back-to-back days of hits, and more doubles on the season than Polanco and Crawford combined. You can thank Clase for the perfect record so far and the series win of the year, and this is just the start. Like Swaggerty and Cobby, we needed one for the speedy little guys, and though he may not be Italian, his name ends in a vowel, so our grandparents would happily claim him.
Well done. Well done. Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No. I mean,
I'm so right.
Chaos Ball was back.
This is the Mariners again. That is how you... I think there is maybe a science to it.
I just... Like, how are they going to be able to maintain it when Canzone comes back? I don't know how long he's going to be out, but...
It was a significant amount of time was the description. That's like to Pete Carroll. What is the term?
Legit.
A legit. That's a legit injury.
We're not going to have any more legit injuries. Well, wow.
Maybe Mike McDonald will learn, but or maybe we'll have actual information.
Or maybe Pete Carroll will start giving injury updates at UW practice. Yeah,
they'll be even more mysterious than they are without an injury report. I don't think we need to worry about that right now. We need to see. We said the same thing about Cobby last year, and Swaggerty. We definitely did. Right away, it was like, "Oh, Cobby's going to take Swaggerty's spot." Like, it's
I guess we did say that,
and we were nervous about it. I never loved him in the way that I could have. And again, 0.7 WAR already for the Rays. And if you want,
is it all defensive again?
No, he's hitting also. Huh. The difference between him and Luke Raley is almost a full game, because Luke Raley's negative, and Cobby is positive. It is almost a full game. The difference between those two players, the one-to-one trade that the Mariners made. I'm not saying it was the wrong decision, but the fact that the Rays wanted Jose Caballero should have been a reason that the Mariners shouldn't have wanted to have traded him.
Well, again, much of his value to the Rays is playing shortstop, which he would not do for the Mariners.
Sure.
Unless you would argue he's better than J.P. Crawford.
I mean, honestly, he might be.
Look, 2-for-5 today for J.P. It looked a lot better. The top of the order got hits today? That's a legal thing?
In the Class A era, the Mariners scored the most runs that they'd scored all year in regulation. Since we last talked, the Mariners have scored 6-plus runs multiple times. Only one time in regulation. But it has happened multiple times. And I'm going to tell you, I didn't think it could be done, even after this weekend, because of how desultory it was. How horrible it was
to be
at the ballpark.
Love that word, desultory.
Yeah, I think that's two desultories in a row. That the Mariners feel like they have energy. And if I had told you before the season that 18 games in, Luis Castillo would be 0-4 and the Mariners would be one game out of the AL West, you're saying you would take that.
What if I told you before the season that Luis Castillo would be 0-4 and the Mariners would be 2.5 games ahead of the Astros?
I actually think, despite the negative 15 run differential, this is a situation
only
like,
third worst in the AL West.
I mean, the AL West for some reason looks very bad, but I think this is kind of one of those situations like we saw in basketball sometimes. Eventually, right? We talked about this in both of the college championship games that happened. Everybody else came out hot, but eventually things even out. And if you have the roster and you have Jonathan Class A, all of a sudden it's a long season and things are going to make up for that. The pitching staff has gotten a lot better. Logan Gilbert, like the three games in a row for Castillo. I mean, even Hancock, Hancock, Castillo, Kirby, Gilbert all pitched pretty solid games back to back to back to back. And the pitching is looking a little bit more normal.
Oh, yeah.
The Cubs series, they were just crushed by Michael Busch and not being able to score any runs. But that is in the pre-Class A era. Times are different in these
separate
two-game sample size.
All of Mariners history into before and after.
But I'm telling you, Jonathan they always have had a player like that. And when they started the year, they didn't have a player like that.
Dylan Moore is the enemy here?
That's not what Dylan Moore does, really.
Yes, I agree. No, yes. I'm not saying it's Dylan Moore's fault personally, but he's not.
But Dylan Moore is the enemy.
Dylan Moore is the op, I should say.
Yeah, Dylan Moore is the ops.
I wanted to talk about, so until, I don't know, is this still the case that when the Mariners, until Monday night, the Mariners were 1-10 when they allowed more than one run in a game? It's a truly shocking stat. But
if they allowed a run.
One of the exactly, they're in good shape as long as they allowed run. One of the things I've been reflecting on a lot lately is like the more notable a statistic is, the more interesting it is, the less likely it is to mean anything going forward.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wait, it was no, not your statement.
Oh, the 1-10.
One because they beat the Guardians 5-4, they beat the Red Sox 4-3, they beat the Brewers 5-3.
Oh, okay. Maybe it would. For me, I'm quoting, remembering this
and
wrong entirely.
And the Cubs 4-2. Maybe it was starting pitching or something.
Maybe that was it. That would make more sense.
But no, a lot of that was starters anyway, though.
I don't know. Well, here we are rejecting stats that aren't actually true anyway. Yeah, the starting pitcher yields more than one run.
Okay.
This is Danny O'Neill who had it. Or at least that is popping up here. I might not have been him that I originally
saw. Because the bullpen has been...
No, the bullpen has actually not been very good lately. If you look at FIP, I was looking at that today. The starting pitcher's FIP, other than Arison Hancock, all very solid. The bullpen, not so great.
Is it the... Where's the FIP on here?
I mean, that probably normalizes a little faster for starting pitchers than it does for relievers. Many of these relievers have pitched like six innings this season. I like that, like...
Also, Jorge Polanco's making defensive plays. Like, the back-to-back days of homers for... I think Polanco's fine.
I agree.
The Mariners stuck with him for more than 10 games.
Does he already have more homers than Colton Wong? I was noting
he
also...
probably does as a Mariner.
Yeah. I was noting...
Colton Wong, he actually had a couple of... I distinctly remember a couple of homers.
He maybe had three or four, I would say.
He had two. Already more than Colton Wong.
Okay, there you go.
Is that really a fair comparison? Colton Wong's not like a power hitter.
I'm aware, yes. I get that. But what was Colton Wong? What was he good at? What is it you would say you do here? I enjoyed on the Baseball Reference page that they have like the top five relievers by innings pitched and then a cutoff, which seems a little archaic now. But Ryan Stanek wasn't one of the top five relievers because he's a leverage pitcher and there hadn't been enough leverage situations.
No, it has not been that much Stanek, although it kind of made a sweat earlier today.
Definitely did, but look, it was thrilling in the end when Taylor Cicedo came in to get that save.
Colton Wong was a very good player for a handful
of
years.
I'm aware. I'm just saying in his Mariners era, it wasn't like he was compensating for the lack of power with something else.
Sometimes it happened. They paid him $10 million.
Did they pay him all that $10 million? Or maybe, I guess they did, but they got off of Jesse Winker's salary, which was similar. Jesse Winker homered for the Nats. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, he homered at Dodger Stadium.
Sometimes it happens where a player's career, they're just done instantly overnight in baseball.
But it apparently has not happened with Jorge Polanco.
No.
Rumors of Jorge Polanco's demise have been greatly exaggerated. I thought you were going to bring up Julio Rodriguez getting picked off to end Sunday's game because that seemed
we're all positive here.
That seemed like it. Well, no, but it seemed like it had the chance to be a flashpoint moment. And I was like, oh, good. At least we're getting like the Julio backlash out of the way early so that we can get back to, you know, his continued upswing. But Tuesday, redemption.
The catch that he made?
It's spelled, today we spell redemption, Julio. The two hits, the catch, the throwing out a guy at the plate.
Well, he threw him out at third base.
Or at third base, yes.
But you're it right. Saved run at the plate.
Yes.
I don't really acknowledge anything that happened in the pre-Class A era. And it felt to me, if you're going to have a low point, you might as well have the low point as early as possible in the season. And Julio Rodriguez being picked off, coming in for that play.
Not pinch hitting, being used as a pinch runner instead.
Just the full on, you had one job and getting picked off on that play. And just the long review. I tuned in for one play of that game. That was it. Or I saw the Cal Raleigh single. And then I saw Julio Rodriguez get picked off. That was it. That was all I saw from the game.
You saw out?
And that was coming after going to a Mariners game the night before that they scored a single run. And it was a fine night at the ballpark. But the Mariners never felt like they had a chance to score another run. It wasn't like somebody came to the plate and there was an energy in the stadium. It was like people were there to drink and talk to each other and go into the kids area or whatever, eat food. And there happened to be a baseball game happening.
I mean, that's been most of Mariners history.
So it was so different from the last game that we went to last year where we were living and dying on every single play, right? And I get the beginning of the season is going to be different than the end of the season, but there was no energy around the team at all. And I do feel like in a very short period of time that changed. All of a sudden, Julio's making plays. People are hitting the ball.
What convinced you to go to the game on Saturday after your diatribe about the outfield ticket prices?
The children wanted to go.
Okay. That's all it took. Is Tay a Mariners fan?
Absolutely not. No. Question. He said he was, quote, cosplaying as a Mariners fan.
That he uses the term cosplay.
Yeah, he was cosplaying as a Mariners fan. I mean, some of these FIPs, like Saucedo's at 1.33.
I'm not saying everyone in the bullpen, but I'm saying if you look at, like, the team FIP was over four, and, like, four of the five starters are in the threes. So some of that is Hancock.
The sample size is just so little for the relievers.
I'm not like concerned about Andrés Muñoz because of his five FIP. Like, whatever.
I'll defend Austin Voth forever, though, no matter what happens.
Like he's Italian?
Yeah, I'll defend him like he's Italian. Who was the player they had last year who's from Seattle who...
Oh. Well, they had two guys from Seattle. Didn't they acquire two guys at the deadline from Seattle?
No, they picked up this dude earlier, I think. They had him going into the season. He's like fringe AAA majors player. I'll look him up.
Oh, okay.
And I think might have also gone to UW.
Still sounds like it's describing a player that they acquired at the trade deadline.
Was it Cooper Hummel?
No. Cooper Hummel is not a native. There was like a...
Are you sure?
They got somebody from the Giants. And then they got somebody else at the deadline. I can go back and look in the notes if you want, if you really care that much.
No, it's fine. I don't care.
All right, let's get into the roundup.
University of Portland for Cooper Hummel.
Starting, I guess he does have a Northwest tie, with the Kraken, who closed the NHL regular season on Thursday in Minnesota. The Kraken have lost four in a row since our last podcast. They are currently tied for eighth in the lottery standings with the Calgary Flames, who will face lowly San Jose in the season finale. So perhaps a chance for the Kraken to finish alone in eighth. Mentioned Coachella Valley talk. So Shane Wright, after his run of goals, returning to the major league, was sent down over the weekend along with Logan Morrison and Ryan Winterton to play for Coachella Valley in the AHL playoffs, giving them the opportunity to continue their season and their development. The Firebirds have already clinched the Pacific Division Championship which the regular season concluding on Sunday, and they have a bye to the best of five division semifinals in the AHL playoffs.
All right.
So we will follow their run. Not seeing a posted Jonathan Class A. Well, maybe they will. They haven't played since Class A was called up. I was going to say bump or the Seattle Sounders, who were back to their non-scoring ways on Saturday at FC Dallas in a 0-0 draw. Sounders dominated possession but had just 8 shots, 2 on goal. They did create 1.5 expected goals to 0.9 for Dallas, according to the MLS stats. Probably the best news from this game was that Joel Paulo was stretched out to the final 25 minutes plus stoppage time as he continues to work his way back from injury. Also working back, Pedro de la Vega, who practiced Tuesday 6 weeks after his hamstring injury ruled him out. Brian Schmetzer told reporters the Sounders will be cautious with de la Vega's return, but it is possible he plays off the bench this week. As the Sounders have the first Cascadia Cup clash of the season on tap Saturday, Vancouver visiting Lumen Field. The Whitecaps come in second in the Western Conference with the conference's best goal differential. They've already had 9 different players score and 8 different players record assists in a balanced attack. Reign FC also part of the Seattle Swoon, the pre-class Seattle Swoon.
Pre-class A. We're fully committing to it, the two games.
You gotta go all or nothing. You gotta go all in here. A wild loss Sunday.
We did this for the
Reign in their first ever visit to Bay FC as the teams traded goals in the final 10 minutes before stoppage time. Bethany Balser equalized off a Jisoo Yoon feed before
It was Jake Lamb, right?
Yeah. Before an own goal in the 87th minute gave Bay FC the win. Bay FC peppered the Reign with 23 shots, 7 of them on goal, to just 8 shots, 3 on goal for the Reign. That loss dropped the Reign to 12th in the NWSL standings with only one team. The Portland Thorns, who fired their coach, or reassigned their coach, I should say, on Tuesday, having fewer points this season. The Reign played without Jordan Heidema, who was injured for Canada in the She Believes Cup final loss to USWNT on penalties last week. Reign will be back home on Sunday after an 0-3 road stretch to host Chicago, which comes in fourth in the NWSL standings with 7 points.
Okay, can I read to you some names of people who had at-bats in the 2022 Mariners season?
This was 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Okay.
I remember pretty much everybody. I remember everybody who had an at-bat in 2023.
Uh-huh.
2022 was sort of teetering. You tell me if you've heard of any of these individuals.
Definitely did not start paying attention until late June.
Well, you didn't start paying attention until that one series at the end of the year. You got the Pagliacci pizza.
No, that was 21.
That was 21? Okay, so this is the year the Mariners went to the playoffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that was 21 that you started paying attention.
Yeah.
22, you got on board late June.
After the NBA season ended and the Jesse Winker fight.
Because I remember the low point of this year, and that was when Kevin Padlo was playing first base. Now, that name you don't even remember?
No.
If you don't remember that one, let me just...
Oh, no. It gets worse from here.
Oh, it is not even close. Jack Larson. These are people who had at-bats for the Mariners in the season.
Jack Larson is part of the ownership group.
Travis Jankowski, Stuart Fairchild, Drew Ellis, Andrew Knapp, Marcus Wilson, all the way up through Steven Souza Jr.
Nope.
It is somebody named Donovan Walton was on the roster. Where did they find these guys? It's like when you get a roster and there's all the real players and then there's like filled out like the rosters for 2K.
Yeah.
When they have like all the classic players and then there's like five fake players at the bottom and they all are number 55 and went to UCLA. That's what this Mariners team is. You're just like Drew Ellis, Stuart Fairchild. You know, there's somebody out there who's like, oh, I remember the Jankowski at bat.
Oh, I'm fine. That person is in our Discord posting about this as they listen.
How many of these people do you think got hits?
Two.
Drew Ellis got a hit. Brian O'Keefe, I remember.
Yeah, Brian O'Keefe, backup catcher, right?
Yes. Marcus Wilson got a hit.
O'Keefe like played a key role at times last year, didn't he? Or was he not around last year?
I mean, he played 8 games. He had 2 hits all year. Define key role. In Mariners lore, that's playing a key role, hitting 105 in 8 games.
It's like the back like, of well, this.
He got on base.
It's like the back of that set.
I think you're thinking of like Luis Torrens or Kurt Casale or somebody like that.
No, I remember O'Keefe separately from Torrens. O'Keefe didn't pitch.
No, Torrens was a ball player.
Yeah, I mean, Torrens was the winning hit against the Yankees in the extra inning game, too,
and then
right?
Got released.
Yeah. We will always remember Luis Torrens. Seattle Storm.
Andrew Knapp.
Drafted UConn guard Nika Mühl at number 14 and Indiana forward Mackenzie Holmes, number 26 in Monday's WNBA draft. Do you know Nika Mühl?
No, should I?
Yeah, she was the one that defended Caitlin Clark.
Oh.
In the Final Four.
Kind of shut her down.
Also, a point guard who wore number 10 at UConn and finished a career is the Huskies' all-time leading scorer. Just in case that particular, or all-time leading assister, I should say, just in case that particular form.
I was going to say, all-time leading scorer, that's like, even being the all-time leading assister is pretty impressive.
She would not have gotten number 14 if she was the all-time leading scorer at UConn. I can guarantee you that. But she passed Sue Bird's record. Sue's assist total at UConn deflated a little bit because she missed so much of her freshman season due to an ACL tear. But still an impressive feat nonetheless. Obviously, Subert isn't the only good point guard who has ever played at UConn.
Recognize one. I don't recognize that other one.
Huh?
Diana Taurasi?
I mean, yes. Not known for her assist totals at UConn, certainly. Mühl probably better known for her defense after matching up with Clark and is a two-time Big East Defensive Player of the Year. Definitely very low usage for a WNBA prospect at 13% usage rate as a senior, which is basically the same throughout her career. Shot 40% on threes this past season, but 36% career and 66% career on free throws.
Not great.
Which is not a great indicator.
Should we go through?
We can talk about Mühl. I mean, this is
Is she going to make the roster?
She's got a chance.
Don't need they have people who can score.
Yes.
That's not what they need, and that's not what anybody needs. I mean, even the 14th pick seems so absurd to be like, when you get all the way down to the 14th pick, that's not what you need. But
it's the second round.
But that's not what any team needs from a player in that place. So I feel like having anything that you do well, having one special skill, is probably a better way to find your way to a roster and minutes on the court rather than just being an overall fine player.
Probably.
Right?
I mean, I think the question is just, you know, if you're a low-volume scorer at the college level, is that just by the time you translate it to the WNBA such a weakness that your strengths can't overcome it? I think is the question we need to find out.
40% on threes. Like, if you're taking wide-open threes, she can hit them. It's not like, because that would be the issue, is that no one is defending you.
Yeah.
And it's like it's 5-4 with everybody else.
You need some playmaking out of your point guard, I think, even if you've got...
But you don't get that many assists without playmaking. I mean, I understand...
But you have to be a threat to score.
But I'm saying that you don't get that many assists without being a threat to score. Unless UConn was so much better than their opponents that she's just easily getting the ball to scorers and they're doing something, in which case that shouldn't be an assist.
I wouldn't say that. It's more just like...
You need to have a threat to score to even put yourself in the position to get an assist.
And typically the players who, play those roles in the WNBA are much bigger stars in college. Like, this is something I actually looked at.
Who played
how low
like defensive
her usage
stopper
rate.
School, like roles, contributors, things like that. Yeah.
So like Breon January was an example of that towards the tail end of her career, and really probably throughout even her prime years. I don't know what her highest usage rate was. And she probably, averaged 15 points per game when she was in college.
But also, this is at UConn where like...
True. And like the most effective low usage player in the WNBA was Kia Stokes, who was a center at UConn towards the tail end of the Stewie era, was, I think, drafted the year before. And I guess not the tail end. It was the front end, because she was drafted the year before Stewie, the same year the Storm took Jewel Lloyd and Kalena Mosqueda Lewis.
But UConn's not looking for Nika Mule to score. They have other scores. To me, the fact that she was even getting on the court is still an important indicator.
Yeah. It's positive. So, I mean, she's not guaranteed a roster spot. Breon January didn't score that many points per game. She topped it out at 12.3, but had a usage as high as 22.5 as a senior. So we talked about this last week. They have 6 guaranteed spots, 11 players on the roster. Jordan Hordston is sure to make the roster, so that's 7. And then you've got Jade Melbourne and coming back, along with Dulce Fankum Mengiato, who are likely to get spots but not guaranteed them. And then said beyond them, that leaves 2 spots for Mule and then the players that they've invited to training camp, including Victoria Vivians, who's a longtime WNBA veteran. One of the things that Storm front office said, Noel Quinn and Talisa Rhea said after the draft, is it's not necessarily an either-or battle between Jade Melbourne and Nika Mule, but I think that will be the primary competition for the backup point guard spot going into the season. I mean, certainly if you were to look at it like an area of the Storm, relatively weak backup point guard, depending on how you're projecting Melbourne's development, and she's also a bit of a combo, but I think more of a one. Like that was a spot that there was an opening.
Can I ask some overall questions, or do we want to talk about who else they're bringing to camp first?
Yeah, let's talk about their 3rd-round pick, Mackenzie Holmes, who will not join the Storm for training camp, because she announced before the draft she plans to undergo knee surgery to address an ongoing issue that limited her at Indiana. The Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year in 2022-23, Holmes led the conference in blocks per game 3 years running, 65% career two-point shooter on high volume, peaked at 22.3 points per game in 2022-23. Probably got to be an undersized 5 at the WNBA level, since she doesn't have 3-point range, making just 10 in her career. But at that point in the draft, I like the idea of, it's draft, Mackenzie Holmes will wait a year and she can be in training camp in 2025.
What is she going to do in the meantime? Is she going to be on the roster, just injured?
She can't be on the roster, but I think there is some ability for her to rehab the injury with the team.
It's kind of a strange situation to be in.
It is, but it's not terribly uncommon.
She need to get a job? Like, I don't... That's the thing that's so strange to me, is like... Is she going to be able to financially live for a year?
I can't speak to Mackenzie Holmes' situation specifically. She planned the surgery knowing what the outcome was going to be.
It's a strange one. If this were the NBA, would that be different?
There are a variety of different approaches that NBA teams take in this situation. Depending on how high a draft pick you were, they might just sign you and keep you on the roster. I mean, it certainly does happen. Minnesota.
Is it a roster spot issue? It's not a money issue.
It's a roster spot issue. Yeah.
Could the WNBA just add a roster spot for injured players, or everybody would just stash them?
That was why they don't have one, yes.
But who is that helping? It's literally only hurting players, right?
It's helping the owners not pay as much money.
What is the salary? $70,000?
I agree. I'm not arguing this. I'm not arguing that's a good thing. Like, Jalen Clark would be an example of this in the NBA. He tore his Achilles, I believe, at UCLA. The Timberwolves drafted him, had him on a two-way this year, I believe, and he did not play an entire minute all season, just rehabbed the entire time.
And was with the Timberwolves, or?
Mm-hmm.
Because I do feel like there's a value to being around the team.
I agree.
That's very stupid. Okay. I want to come back to the draft for a second, because I think there was a surprise, my little paying attention to the draft. Rekia Jackson goes at pick 4, which was the Storm's pick, correct?
Yes.
Was that a surprise that that happened?
When we talked last week, I wasn't certain what my ESPN colleague Michael Vopel had in the mock draft. The final version did have Camilla Cardoso from South Carolina going 3rd to Chicago and Jackson going 4th.
If Rekia Jackson is there, if you could redo this offseason, the Storm could have Rekia Jackson. Done, right? Signed, sealed, delivered. You know that that's going to happen. Do you still trade that pick?
I mean, number one, yes. Like, you still make a trade with to clear cap space because you signed Skylar Diggins-Smith and Neko Okwemeke. Like, that's a good outcome, no matter what. No matter what had happened in the
draft.
But
Skylar Diggins-Smith and Neko Okwemeke are not that young.
I agree. They're just extremely great all-time players. Rekia Jackson, in my projections, among the players that I had in there, which is all the drafted players and a few others, ranked 36th in my projections. I don't trust my WNBA draft projections.
Ranked 36th of everybody?
Yeah.
Coming out of college?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
If you had to do a combination, your projections plus eye test or whatever, like if you had to make a big board.
Yeah, I wouldn't put her 36th on my big board.
But so you're not that upset about the idea of not getting Rekia Jackson?
I think people liked the idea of what Rekia Jackson is a player better than the statistical reality of what she did at Tennessee.
Okay. All right.
So if Cardoso had been there at 4, that I think would have been a miss for the
Really?
Storm. Oh, yeah.
Wow. I watching her, I didn't think that was like a translate to the next level type skill set.
I mean, I think 6'7 is always going to train. Like, I would say, because this conversation came up in the Discord with some skepticism, Cardoso's size, her relative mobility at the size, I think it's a similar package to Mercedes Russell, but I think she's more skilled offensively than Mercedes Russell.
It was just like athletically getting up and down the court. She was not moving in that game. I felt like you have to kind of build your offense around her in a way that most teams are not capable of doing.
I don't think you have to, no. I mean, she's not going to really be a pick-and-roll threat necessarily, but...
But there are a lot of times that you're going to be playing 4-on-5 if you're trying to fast break.
I just don't think that's that common of an issue.
Okay. I mean, it was the same thought that I had about Zach Edey. Yeah, where it was like...
Yeah, I don't... I mean, Edey, I think, is more of an issue because, again, Edey, I think, is going to be limited defensively in ways that Cardoso isn't because the WNBA does not have as many stretch fives. I think Cardoso will be one of the league's better defensive players. I don't think that about Edey.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you think they'll just stretch him out and then he'll be useless in the paint.
I wouldn't say useless, but...
Because he can't defend. Really good centers who are defenders can defend both the perimeter and in the paint.
You have to be able to defend at least a little bit in the perimeter.
And you don't think Zach Edey can?
I think that's going to be a challenge for him.
Who's going to win Defensive Player of the Year?
Rudy Gobert.
So, okay, if you're Rudy Gobert, I wasn't sure if he was still that good. If you're Gobert, you obviously a good paint defender, shot blocker, whatever. If there's a stretch five that he's playing against, he can go out and play them in the perimeter.
Sure. I mean, his value is neutralized to a degree then because he's not protecting the rim.
But there aren't that many teams who have that good of a stretch five that you need Rudy Gobert to be out there.
Exactly.
So, okay. Being at the end of this offseason, more or less, right? There's not that much more for the Storm.
Yeah, they may sign someone to fill out the training camp roster since they aren't bringing McKenzie Holmes, and they probably had penciled in someone in that spot.
But this is it. This is the roster. They have two. They signed two all-time great WNBA players, both 33. For this season, because to me, I was actually thinking of this with the Mariners. But the idea that this is a completely kind of separate related issue. I was at the Mariners game with Marco, and he was like, when was the last time the Mariners won the World Series? And I was like, that would be never. And he's like, but when was the last time they went to the World Series? Oh. And I'm like, also never. And he's like, because it says that like AOS champion, you see it and you're like, wow, it was a really fucking long time. Just if you were a human being living through the 20 years between going to the playoffs is such a long time to be a human being. And there's this idea.
You had so many children in that
span. Oh my God, almost all of them. And there's a reality that...
Which end would you not have had children on?
What?
Which end would you not have had children on? The 16 end or the 2 years ago end?
What 16 end?
Like when you were age 16.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Good God. so young. And then by the time they went to the playoffs again, I was so old. That's my point, which is the ownership is like, well, we don't want to sell out for 1 year. And it's like, motherfucker, sell out for 1 year. You have no years. If you've never won a World Series, selling out for a single season, it's like, what are we building toward?
I mean,
the idea, there's never been a sustained period of success in the entire team's history. And they're like, but now maybe there's the chance of long-term sustained success. You should always be selling out for a single year.
I want to have the 54% debate here.
It's not the 54% debate. It's just like, try winning sometime.
It is the 54% debate. But it's not like basketball where Rudy Gobert is a great example of this. The Timberwolves have like severely compromised their long-term potential to build around Anthony Edwards by trading for Rudy Gobert with all the draft picks and the salary, etc. But they are really good right now.
Nobody's like, wow, it sure sucks watching the Timberwolves because in 5 years it might be bad.
Probably are not going to win championship.
But there's no
equivalent of a Rudy Gobert in basketball because one player doesn't matter that much. Like you can load up you know who loaded up for last year? Who was all in
the
on
Mets.
1 year? No, I mean
they definitely were. They signed Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander.
Sure, but the example I'm thinking of is like because when people say this, they don't necessarily mean before the season. They mean at the trade deadline. And who was the team that made a bunch of additions at the trade deadline because they knew they might not be as good the next year?
In baseball?
Yeah. A very famous team traded a bunch of players at the trade deadline.
Who?
The Los Angeles Angels.
Oh, kind of.
Who then immediately got smoked by the Mariners who had sold at the trade deadline because the trade deadline doesn't matter that much in baseball.
They were praying for something to happen. It wasn't the same as like going out and getting players like Justin Verlander back. Like the Mets are a better example of they spent a ton.
But I don't think they were necessarily like, we just got this 1 year and it's all, they weren't thinking like it's going to be Florida Marlins. We got to time this for the 1 year where we're going to win the World Series and then we'll sell off everyone.
Teams have done it a lot and then failed. The Padres did it pretty famously, right? Also
so,
failed.
So your strategy again is to do the thing that teams have done it a lot and failed.
But also teams have done it and not failed.
Who?
I mean, the Diamondbacks traded prospects or whatever for players and then went to the World Series. From the Mariners, this happened. They traded for Paul Sewald.
I don't think Paul Sewald was the entire difference between, like...
But you were like the Marlins strategy, and the Marlins did that multiple times. It has been successful. The Padres in the 90s did it. They loaded up, right? David Wells, David Cohn, players like that. This has
David
happened.
David Cohn played for the Padres?
I'm pretty sure that David Cohn pitched for the Padres.
I'm very confident he did not. Like, this is in my baseball wheelhouse. I might not know who appeared in games for the Mariners in 2022, but I know David Cohn's career. No SDP on there. I guarantee it. Many New York teams. Well, maybe even all the New York teams.
Who did they trade for that year?
Toronto, Kansas City.
All right, fine.
Boston? He was in Boston at
the
end of his
career?
I'll
take the L on David Cohn.
Yeah. Okay.
But you should always... The idea that anybody can predict the future and what is going to happen...
You're making the case for Neko Ogumike and Skylar Diggins-Smith here.
I am. That's what I'm saying. Is that you should always be trying to win right now because, again, what is the Pelton Cast golden rule? It's a little bit more about how you'll feel in a situation. But also... I'm telling you this, if you could have gone back in time to 1998, 2001 or whatever.
I agree that in 2001 they should have traded for a left fielder.
And told that person, this rapper on this Outkast album is going to record a flute record. That is a thing that happened.
Mariners make the playoffs for the next time.
We are so bad at predicting the future that you should always try to be as good as you are in the present. Because the future is completely unknown.
No, but we're so bad at the future that you should give yourselves more future opportunities. That's why you're like arguing the team should trade up in the draft. Did you read the Athletics piece today?
About the NFL draft? Yeah. But no, there's a difference.
It was like, everyone knows what they should do, but they get in there and they don't do it.
I don't agree with that.
Teams are failing the marshmallow test over and over again.
Because we're talking about value and resources. They are not using their resources correctly in the NFL draft.
The most valuable
picks in the draft are in the second round. The most valuable baseball players on the field, like literally players in the... There is a hard salary cap in the NFL, and you have to balance it. Now, should you pay a quarterback as much as possible? Should you probably draft a quarterback every single year if you don't have one? Yes, that's what you should do, because you're working within this world. Baseball isn't working within that world. And even
everyone is working within a certain extent,
it's not enough money in the salary cap. The salary cap is probably going to go up significantly over the next handful of years. Like
in 2026 is when it will go up.
That's when the TV deal happens.
That's when the next CBA will kick in.
I think that the WNBA, you probably should be spending almost always right now. You should be trying to win right now. But also players, your young star players can get injured. They can get bad. Like just counting on something in the future happening is not a good strategy.
But the question is the future undervalued or overvalued? And the answer is the future is always undervalued because people...
Sometimes winning right now is undervalued, though.
I think it was the right decision for the Storm, because one of the things they also did was they got this unprotected 2026 first round pick for the Sparks. They knew that there was a hard upside on this year's first round pick, that it was not going to be a star prospect, because they knew that Paige Bueckers was not coming out. Like, everyone knew this within the league.
But so, even if Paige Bueckers was, like, I guess that means that they could get Cardozo.
Correct. But what they did is in 2026, like, look, odds are the Sparks are going to be better because they'll have Cam Brink and pretty good chance they'll have Paige Bueckers because they're the early favorite to have the number one pick in 2025.
It's still a lottery.
I agree. But they've given themselves, like, things could fall out. The bottom could fall out in LA, and then you could end up with a better pick in 2026 than you give in 2024, plus the cap space to go away, go sign Neko Gumake away from the Sparks.
I think this was the right way to handle this offseason.
The bummer part of it is if they hadn't signed Kia Nurse to a 2-year contract a year ago, they wouldn't have needed to make that trade. They could have, you know,
done all this
and had the number 4 pick. But that's the 2026 LA pick is what makes it.
They would have probably drafted Rickea Jackson, who you're telling me right now is probably not going to be that good of a player.
I mean, look, I've been wrong so often.
Exactly. People are bad at predicting the future. I don't know if you saw this. You literally are trying to predict the future.
So Bill Simmons, in our Bill Simmons, they were tracking their over-under picks. Uh-huh. And for comparison, decided to throw in the projections from John Hollinger and myself. My projections this year went 9-21 against the Vegas lines.
Wow.
Which I need to...
You're way better at football, just off the dome.
I don't know how.
You should stop doing these projections and just start off-the-cuff vibes.
I mean, it wasn't off-the-cuff, but yes.
But like when you did it for football, you weren't doing extensive research like that.
But I was looking at the statistical projections. Wasn't straight fast.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Aaron Schatz is better at this than you are. They were like, how did Simmons do, by the way?
I didn't even pay attention, honestly. I was so shook.
About how bad you did?
I knew I did poorly.
Shaken your core?
But I didn't know.
You were like, Blankenship's not in the draft?
he's not in my draft projections.
Okay. A draft has happened. WNBA?
Yeah.
The Storm are still hovering around third right now?
There's a pack of teams that can legitimately believe they're going to be the third best team in the WNBA this year. Maybe including Indiana. Who knows? Wouldn't rule it out.
I've gone on record as being a mild Caitlin Clark skeptic at the WNBA level.
I'm not. Definitely not. I think Connecticut, if I'm doing it today, Connecticut.
This is like the golden era. It's been a long time since Indiana basketball was this good.
It has.
Overall.
Yeah, it really has. Connecticut would be my third team. The Storm would be fourth. And then Dallas, fifth. And Atlanta, sixth. But again, you could make a case for, I think, any of those teams. And then even Phoenix or Indiana.
Are New York and Vegas so good that they could withstand injury, regression?
Well, Vegas did win the title last year with Candace Parker injured for the entire second half. So I would say yes.
Are there any players that are so essential to those teams?
I mean, part of the reason that makes them super teams is they have the ability that, you know, say Breanna Stewart were decided not to play in the second half of the season for personal reasons. Jonquel Jones could just step in and be the MVP a couple of years ago. So... But, I mean, it's a, you know, in a short series, could the Storm upset one of those teams? It's like, plausible. It passes the any chance rule.
Okay.
And if they're back in the semifinals, that'd be very exciting.
When does the season start again?
May 18th.
All right, we're getting there.
We are getting there. All right, UW softball won 15-9 last Wednesday in a wild game at Boise State. Riley Holtorf and Brooke Nelson hit a pair of home runs apiece, while Olivia Johnson also had one. Ruby Malin allowed just one run in three and a third inning starting, but Nelson and Sydney Peters got hit hard in relief before Lindsay Lopez came on to see out the victory. Huskies moved up two spots to number 8 ahead of this weekend's visit to number 24 Cal. The Golden Bears are ranked despite a 4-9 start to conference play.
I've done some soul searching. Some reflecting on the rankings in college softball. I don't think that many teams play. it's way too easy to be ranked. Like we have.
There's lots of unranked teams in other conferences.
We have college basketball and college football brain when we think about the rankings, and it is easier to be ranked in the top 25 than it is in those other sports.
I mean, it is somewhat because there's only like 9 schools in the Pac-12, but I don't think it's like half as many teams.
They're 4-9 and they're ranked.
So they've played a brutal schedule. After hosting the Huskies, they'll have played all 5 other ranked Pac-12 foes in their first 6 weekends of conference play. And then they finish their last 2 or against the other 2 unranked foes. So their record will probably improve by the end. And they were probably pretty good in non-conference, I have to assume. All right, UW football, the latest fallout from the arrest of running back Tybo Rogers on multiple charges of rape. The athletic department released an updated statement last week that after our podcast that read in part, "The criminal complaint released on April 9th by the prosecutor's office contained information new to the university, and we immediately took additional appropriate actions to address safety concerns. Had the university had this new information earlier, including in the fall or winter, we would have done the same at that time." So sort of speaking specifically to this idea that Rogers was allowed to play in the college football playoff after he missed the Pac-12 championship due to some sort of off-field issue that they have not made public specifically what that was. But the timing does match up to when this investigation began and when these allegations against him were first made public. Former Husky coach Kaywin DeBoer also released a statement through the Alabama Athletic Department on Rogers' arrest. "While I am not able to comment specifically on the situation involving an individual at my former institution because of federal privacy laws and the ongoing criminal matters, I do want to make it clear that I take any allegation of sexual misconduct very seriously. I always have and always will follow established institutional policies and procedures to ensure prompt reporting and proper handling of allegations by the appropriate authorities." So we have not yet had any additional reporting basically on what the UW Athletic Department knew and when they knew, which is kind of the relevant question here. In less important on-field concerns, Husky safety Vincent Holmes Jr., who briefly switched to wide receiver at the start of spring's practices, submitted a notification of transfer. Tuesday was the opening of the spring portal window. That's the window for players to submit their notification of transfer. They can choose their new destination at any point up to the beginning of the season. All right, lastly,
you're not going to mention the commitment of Raiden Vines-Bright? All right.
You know, it's an exciting development. It's a long ways off. Let's see if he actually signs a letter of intent.
It is interesting to have just like that we're going to have such strong Arizona connection right now.
Yes.
Because of Jed Fish. But to me, it's like, this is different than Mike Hopkins finding gems in upstate New York.
100%.
This is Jed Fish laid groundwork in Arizona. Didn't have any background in Arizona before then.
Nope.
And he went and signed players like this. And he went and signed players who are still at the University of Arizona, right?
And some who are at the University of Washington, like Ephesians Prysock. And...
Oh, yeah. So the fact that Jed Fish, he obviously was recruiting Raiden Vines-Bright at Arizona, had such a strong relationship with him, and that player believed in him so much that he followed him so far to the University of Washington, to me, is huge. But also just that he was able to go have those relationships and do that and establish that groundwork in a pretty short period of time at Arizona. I don't know. I really think Jed Fish can build something very, very big here and get these players in the interim. But when he's recruiting in the Northwest, I think people are going to fucking love him in the Northwest, recruits that are coming out. I think he might be the coach who can end the Ohio State connection in Seattle. But also, as he's doing more recruiting in California and places like that, like Jed Fish establishing these relationships, to me, it's that the trust that players have and the excitement and the relationships that he's able to build. I thought this was actually low-key kind of huge.
I don't know if this individual signing says all of that, but yes.
But that's what I'm saying. It's an individual signing that is about more than just Raiden Vines-Bright. It's about the program that Jed Fish had built at Arizona. This is not about UW. Raiden Vines-Bright probably didn't know shit about UW. Really?
I'm sure that UW had also reached out under the former coaching staff.
But this is different.
I agree.
And it's in a short period of time. He doesn't have any success at UW so far to pitch to a player like that. But he has his relationship and he has his success at Arizona to pitch. So beating out teams that are bigger and have had... obviously not better in the short term than UW was last year, except for Michigan, but beating out programs that are bigger institutions, college football institutions, for a player like this because of those relationships, I think is a big deal.
All right, let's close with the Seahawks. We mentioned this at the top, but they signed guard Laken Tomlinson to a one-year deal worth up to $4 million last week. Tomlinson won't count against the Seahawks' compensatory picks because he was released by the Jets. He was on a three-year, $40 million contract that he earned coming off his first Pro Bowl appearance in 2021 with San Francisco. Tomlinson started all 34 games during his two seasons in New York, but waiving him saved the Jets $8 million, was graded a 55 by PFF last season. So fairly middle of the pack starting grade at, that's kind of, we've talked about this throughout the offseason. The Seahawks love to have a competent starter at every position so they don't feel like they need to reach and draft Troy Fautano.
Not reach. I mean, if he was drafted there, it would just be expected.
True.
It would be exactly on where he should be picked according to every draft expert. They're not going to draft him. They're probably not going to make the pick. But I actually feel like, again, if as much cheap experience depth as you can have on the offensive line is always a good thing.
Yeah.
This is not a position where there's an issue if you have more good players than you need. And to me, Laken Tomlinson, with the pedigree of playing in the Pro Bowl, like, sign me up on a short deal that doesn't cost them a comp pick. $4 million, right?
I mean, where they're finding the $4 million when they were already at negative effective cap space, according to Over the Cap, is one question mark. But
they're going to trade out of the first round.
I don't have any issues.
That's how they're going to find it.
I do think that is part of their strategy, but I have no...
They're going to find that money by not drafting Troy Fautano.
I have no complaints about this particular contract.
I wonder if Troy Fautano is just like, I'm going home. He reads all these mock drafts. He's like not heard any of the things that John Schneider has said. He's can't wait for the Seahawks to draft me.
Oh, no. Can I close this out tonight with a stat from the great Alex Meyer of Mariners PR?
Absolutely, you can.
Julio Rodriguez, the only major league player this season with an outfield assist and a catch with a lower than or a 5% or lower catch probability in the same inning of a game.
Wow.
which he did.
There we go.
That was in the seventh, right?
That, I mean, that catch was awesome that he made. Skying in. It was such a good catch that Julio, it was an exciting catch, but he also made it look mildly routine.
He did.
Because of how good he is. I was like, oh, that's it. I was like, he played a little bit dramatic, but 5% catch chance. He's just that good and covers that much range. So we love good defense, Julio.
And we love Jonathan Class A.
Oh, absolutely we do.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.